there's things going on during practice and words that are said that directly correlate with what we believe in. The expectations of practice are really high. I know it's a cliche, but I think practices are for coaches and games are for players.
Hello and welcome to Ahead of the Curve. I am Jonathan Gellner, and thank you so much for joining us. This episode is brought to you by Baseball Cloud. Baseball Cloud's revolutionary software platform brings to life the numbers captured by TrackMan and FlightScope. This provides colleges, players, and facility owners around the world a turnkey product, allowing them to analyze their data using key metrics and custom visualizations on one intuitive user interface. Go to baseballcloud.com to find out how you can have your own data analytics department for your program. Data has a story to tell, and Baseball Cloud gives it a voice. Now, on today's show, I welcome Pat Bailey, head coach at Oregon State University. Pat was named Oregon State's interim head coach on September 6th after 11 years as an assistant and associate head coach. In 11 years with the Beavers, Bailey has helped the program to a 2018 national championship, 3 trips to Omaha, and 9 overall postseason appearances. He joined the program as an assistant coach in 2008 and was promoted to associate head coach in 2013. He is a 2-time national championship coach after guiding George Fox to an NCAA Division III title in 2004, and while there, Bailey coached the Bruins for 12 seasons, amassing over 350 wins, 6 conference championships, and a National Coach of the Year award in 2004. On the show, Pat talks with us about how the transition has been since Pat Casey retired, but we also talk about how the culture has been built and cultivated, and he shares with us a ton of common practices that they use that have made his teams successful season after season. I really think you're going to enjoy this one, and here is Pat Bailey. Coach Bailey, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Definitely, and I want to give a huge shout out to Coach Kozderka for putting us in touch, and I know you two are very close, and he had nothing but absolutely glowing things to say about you, and so I'm just thankful that he put us in touch. But you know, I'm really curious to get to know you a little bit better, but if you don't mind, can you give us a little short snapshot of your play, why you got into coaching? And I know you've been at several different stops at a lot of different levels, which we'll get into here in just a minute, but take us through that a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, it started when I was a sophomore in college. I had a teacher, I was majoring in business at the time, and a teacher kept taking me out to dinner and asked me some questions about my future. And one of the things he said to me, when we were talking about it, was he thought I should be a teacher. And honestly, I laughed at him. Said, there's no way I'm going to be a teacher. Teachers don't make enough money. I want to be able to support my family. He said, well, you can teach and you can coach. And I said, well, what would I teach? And he said, well, you can teach business classes. And I didn't even know there was business classes taught in high school at the time. He talked me into taking an education class. I took the education class. I enjoyed it. And that switched my major to business education. And that's how I got started. And my first teaching coaching assignment was at Willamette High School down in Eugene, Oregon in 1978. And I taught business classes and I coached football and baseball. And I was JV baseball coach. I think I coached JV football. It's been a long time ago, but I know I coached varsity football 1 year down there. I was JV the rest of the time. And then I became the head baseball coach at Willamette High School in 1982 when I was 26 years old. Was at Willamette High School for 6 years. While I was there, I got my master's degree at the University of Oregon. And then I took a job up at Westland High School in Westland, Oregon, started there in 1984, was coach football and was the head baseball coach there until 1995. And then 1995, I took the head baseball job at George Fox University, and I was the head baseball coach and associate athletic director there. Mm-hmm. And taught one business class a term. And then I became an assistant coach at Oregon State University in 2007.
Yeah, and you guys have been wildly successful, and you know, you guys are currently in the middle of it as well. And so that's why I'm really excited to get to talk with you about that. And you know, we can be somewhat reflective, but at the same time, you guys have got a shot to win it again this year, and you guys are going to be really, really good. And so what? So I first want to ask you, you know, what has the transition been like after Coach Casey's retirement and after you got to take the reins of the program?
Well, because I've been here for the last 11 years, the transition, I think, has been really easy. I mean, I'm very familiar with Oregon State University. I'm familiar with the climate and the culture at Oregon State University. I was a head baseball coach for 26 years before I got here, so I think I know what I'm doing. And, you know, I'm going to miss working with Coach Casey. We have very similar philosophies. We enjoyed each other's company and time that we spent together, but I'm also very excited to be a head coach again.
Definitely. And, you know, something that I wanted to ask you, and this is something that is a little bit different. You went from being a very successful head coach and to an assistant. And so what was that transition like? You know, you said you had very similar philosophies, so it may not be as drastic, but what was that like taking a step back and getting to learn from somebody like Coach Casey? And, you know, what would be the advice for people, for the listeners out there who may be going through that in the future or have done that in the past?
I mean, I was at a point in my career that I would not have taken an assistant job if it wasn't with somebody that I really felt that we were similar philosophically. And Coach Casey and I have known each other for a long time. I mean, when I was the head coach at Westland High School, when Pat was the head coach at George Fox University and started recruiting, when he finished his pro career, we got to know each other. So I've known him for a long time. When we met, we probably spent the first hour after they got back in 2007 when they won a national championship. We spent, like I said, the first hour just talking about things that had nothing to do with baseball. One of the first questions I asked him is, I said, I know, you know, you're obviously the head baseball coach at Oregon State, but tell me, why do you coach? And we probably spent, like I said, a minimum 1 hour talking about being in the man building business, that we're here to build men of character. And that's number one mission that we have as coaches. And that's 100% what I agree on. It's the most important thing we do. It's more important than winning national championships. When young men leave our program, we want them to be high character guys. And by the way, I think character triumphs over talent any day of the week. And so I just really firmly believe that that's important to us. When guys leave here, we want them to be, if they choose to get married, good husbands. If they choose to have children, be great fathers, be good people in the community, be hard workers, whatever endeavor they choose to go into. We just want them to be great guys when they leave here. And that's the main part of our mission field.
And so you mentioned that that's extremely important to you, and I'm sure that that's something that you guys look for on the recruiting trail. But, you know, I want to know, you guys get guys from different parts of the country with wildly different backgrounds. And it's just, you know, I'm really big into how do we build the culture in a way that benefits everyone, or especially the way that we want it to be built, because I think it's something that can be built. And I'm sure that you have would agree, because you've been in it for the last 10 years. But what are some things that you guys do to build the culture that you guys want them to see?
Well, first and foremost, because of my business background, I'm just going to give you some business type things.
Sure.
One of the critical components is that you have to have very clear expectations. And so from the moment that we start recruiting young men, I'll just give you just a real quick example. If you called me and you were a sophomore in high school, because we can't call them, they have to call us. Mm-hmm. The first time I talked to you, there'd be three things that I talked to you about. These are the foundation pieces of our program. It's our core beliefs. Number one, we're in the man building business, and so we recruit high character guys. And if you're not a high character guy and you don't buy in to doing things right on and off the field, this is not a good place for you to come. The second thing I tell guys is that we want people who are really hard workers, who are going to make the most out of their God-given talent. And hard work to me starts in the classroom and it leaks out onto the baseball field. So we get really good students. Mm-hmm. And then the third piece for me is you've got to make other people more important than yourself. And honestly, between the three, the hardest one is the third one, because we live in a very me, selfish society. So that's one of those things that we work really hard on in our program, is getting guys to generally love and care for each other and forget about their own personal performance. And it's okay for guys to be mad when they're not playing or whatever. Mm-hmm. I always tell them, be mad at the coaches, don't be mad at your teammates, love your teammates, but also communicate with coaches if you're not happy with things, and be willing to come in and talk in the office. And because I can tell you right now, coaches aren't going to play guys because they don't like them. They're going to put the best players on the field that are going to help a team win. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's what puts food on our table. So, you know, that's one of those things that those three are just like the core beliefs of our program, and we abide by them and we do not deter from them.
Well, that's fantastic. And I love that you're getting to share some of the insight of what that looks like. And I've been guilty of this in the past, and this is why I ask for the practicality about it, is I've been guilty of just saying some of those things. And, you know, I'm a true believer that you got to live what you say, or it's just basically the kids aren't going to buy in. But I also want to ask you if there's any practical ways that you guys kind of put those in or concrete those in a way that they see them all the time, or they hear them all the time, or they're basically brainwashed into believing those because they're around all the time. Or is that just something that you say, this is the expectation and this is how it's going to be done? But, and the reason I ask is because I've been guilty of just saying a couple things and then not touching on them for a long time, and then getting mad whenever the kids don't remember what I'm asking them to do. But is there a ways that you go about doing that practically?
Oh, absolutely. It's from the time we start practice till we finish, there's things that go on during practice and words that are said that directly correlate with what we believe in. The expectations of practice are really high. I know it's a cliche, but I think practices are for coaches and games are for players. Mm-hmm. And so in practice, I'm the easiest coach in the world to get along with in practice, as long as you're really focused. You make a commitment every day when you come to practice to be consistently focused and consistent in your performance, and that you just practice hard, which directly correlates in guys doing things right on the field during games. So, you know, there's things behaviorally that we don't put up with in practice. From the get-go, we talked to them about that. And again, that goes back to having really clear expectations about what you want your players, how you want your players to perform during practice. So those things are the stuff that I talk to you about, the core beliefs. I would say that stuff gets covered every single day in practice in one way or another.
I love that. And again, if it's important to us, then it's something that we need to, one, live out, but two, we need to cover it a lot more than I think that we do, and probably over-communicate it. And for me, I'm just speaking to myself there, and something that I definitely need to get better at. And another thing that I really, I hope that you can give us some insight into, is you guys get some of the best in the recruiting world. So there's always going to be some of that internal competition, because the guy next to you is extremely good and you're fighting with him for playing time. You're going to love him, but you want to play. And so is there any ways that you guys integrate competition into your practices, or anything that you guys track that you guys just love to be able to do during practice to kind of make that competitive level go up a little bit?
Well, I'll tell you what, first thing in practice that I think is really important is that you set up practices need to be really organized.
Okay.
First of all, I'll just give you a really quick example. When we do team defense, once we have everything put into our system, we never spend more than 5 minutes on any one thing. An example would be like, we do fly ball communication. I'll just go through an example of a day.
Sure.
First thing we're going to do is we're always going to do something defensive that has to do with our outfielders. So let's say we do fly ball communication. That's going to go 4 minutes. if we do outfield rules and relays, the drill has to do with based on where the ball's hit, that's where you throw the ball to. So you minimize bases, you keep the double play in order when you need to. If we do that, that's going to be 4 or 5 minutes. Then we'll go to maybe rundowns. That'll be 3 minutes. Then we'll go first and third defense. That'll be 5 minutes. Then we'll go pitchers, PFPs will be 5 minutes. So maybe we do a drill we call an island drill. It has to do with pitchers being put out on an island. And it's random. That might be 5 minutes. If we do pitchers picks, where we work on picks with three pitchers out at a time, then that's anywhere from 4 to 7 minutes. So it just depends on what we're doing, but we'll never do anything defense that's more than 8 minutes. But then we also do it, like, for example, bunt defense. We're gonna do bunt defense the minimum 3 times a week when we practice. So I think having practices that are really organized, and one of the worst things young coaches can do is, let's say we're working on bunt defense today as one of our 5 minute segments, and it's going terrible. It's just not going good. When I was a young coach, I'd say, we're going to stay and we're going to do this till we do it right. That's mm-hmm. probably the worst thing you can do, because you know what happens? It just gets worse. So you're better off stopping the drill, briefly talking, going to the next segment of your practice, bringing it back the next day. So no, I just think that's really important that practices are organized and they're to the point. I mean, an adult's attention span is 8 minutes. So why would you do anything for more than 8 minutes?
Well, that's very true. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, batting practice, but even our batting practice stations are how long are your batting practice stations? 8 minutes?
No, they're longer than that. But, you know, when they, for example, if we run a 12-minute, if we go 12-minute rotations okay. in batting practice, and we have 5 segments, 60 minutes total. In those rotations, we never let a hitter swing more than 5 times. Mm-hmm. And that includes all of our situational stuff. So round one might be butt down first, 2 hit and runs, 2 rake and runs, which I used to call run and hit, but we changed the verbiage to rake and run because we want the guys to swing the bat. Mm-hmm. That would be the round one. Round two might be a bunt down third, 2 move-ems where you have runner second, no outs, 2 oppos. Round three might be safety squeeze, 4 score-ems. Round four might be a drag or a push and 4 2-strikes. So, and you end up having about 6 rounds in a 12-minute period. So we'll probably go 4 rounds where we do team stuff, one on the field, and then the other 2 rounds are on their own. But even when they hit, like if they're hitting off the machine, they never get more than 5 swings. And the reason why is because I don't want it to be swinging just to swing. I mean, it's not an aerobic activity. I want there to be focus and purpose to everything that we do.
No, I love that. And you mentioned that you use machines on the field as well?
We do. The Judd's MP3 machine that they introduced last year is the best machine I've ever used. And I really think that it helped us a lot. Last year down the stretch, what we do is we take maybe 4 or 5 rounds live off pitchers, and then we take 2 or 3 rounds off the machine. And it sits up higher, so it's more the angle of what a pitcher actually throws. And it's really easy to adjust from a fastball to a slider to change up whatever you want to throw. So it's just dials. You move it, go back and forth, up and down to get the machine to go left to right, top to down. And it's just, I thought it really helped us down the stretch to have the machine on the field. We can't duplicate mm-hmm. an 82-mile-an-hour slider.
Right.
Just can't do it as a coach. So, and it throws a really good slider. We can't duplicate a 94-mile-an-hour fastball. So those kind of things, we've probably started doing, I'm going to say, the last third of the season. I thought it really helped us out offensively.
Well, I heard that you guys were, you know, you especially are very into vision training. And, you know, the more I dig into it, the more I'm like, man, this is something that isn't touched on enough. But would you mind diving into, you know, just why you guys do that? And then maybe some practical ways that we can start to do that within our team setting and within our programs?
Absolutely. Do you know who Dr. Bill Harrison is?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Dr. Harrison came up here with his son, Ryan. We've had him up a couple times, but he introduced me to vision training stuff. And one of the things he said to me, and it really made sense, and there's a lot more to it than what I'm going to share with you, but what he said to me was that your eyes are muscles. Why would you not train your eyes just like you go and lift weights?
Right.
And the closer you can get both your eyes to work together in terms of muscles, because when we did eye testing on some of the guys, the eye dominance on some guys is a lot more than others. So we do vision training stuff to get both eyes to have to work to get the one eye closer to their dominant eye. So that when they're seeing, they track. It has to do with tracking, has to do with seeing the ball bigger and better. There's just a whole bunch of things go into it. And they're honestly, they're really simple things. We use, I don't know if you've ever seen them on a string, but beads for tracking. The strings are about 8 feet long. We have 5 beads.
Okay.
We have vision boards where you have to cross your eyes to see. It's really interesting. It just looks like a regular picture. But when you cross your eyes and you make the 3 pictures become one in the middle, it becomes 3-dimensional.
Hmm.
And the further you walk away, the more 3-dimensional it becomes. It's actually really cool. But once guys figure out how to cross their eyes and see a picture in the middle, but it forces both your eyes to work is why you cross your eyes, to work equally together. And you have to see it to fully understand it, but some of our guys can back up and see that pitch. I don't know how they can do it. I can't do it. But they can back up as far as 40 feet and still see the picture.
Wow.
Once their eyes cross.
That's
and then the other thing we do is we have a machine that throws little, like, golf ball-sized baseballs that are soft.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the machine from the Jugs Corporation. And we catch those balls with our backhand. And we do it for tracking, to follow the ball in. And we do that from about 40 feet. So those are some of the basic things we do. And then we do some stuff called lane training. And we do some visualization types stuff that has to do with putting 2 balls out in front without even having to swing the bat. Where it's a getting down on time, but it's also seeing the baseball and them giving us feedback verbally after each pitch, just a simple yes or no on how well they saw the ball and whether the ball was in there. But I firmly believe you hit 8.5 inches to the plate. If that's your strength, then you focus on that area and get a pitch in that area. So those are just some of the things that we do that have to do with vision training and tracking.
And so do you work that into your typical batting practice? So say you've got and maybe you could walk us through what the different stations are, but would that be one of the stations that you guys would typically do every day?
Well, one of the stations we do a lot is called lane training. And then the vision stuff that's up at McAlexander, which is a field house right next to our baseball field, that's one of our stations.
Okay.
And we do that. The vision stuff with between the beads, the vision boards, and catching the balls, it takes about 8 minutes total for a group of 4 guys. It's really pretty quick, but it's something we do. We try to do it at least 5 times a week.
Perfect. No, I love that. And again, it's something that, to be honest with you, I don't do it, but I need to. And I just, there's not a lot of practical examples that I've been able to find, because again, it's something that I think is overlooked a little bit. And so have you seen a ton of gains from being able to do that stuff?
Well, if you're talking about charting things and seeing if it's helped us, that I don't know, but I can tell you this. It's just one piece of many that you do to help your players be the best they can be.
Sure.
And just the research and information that I've gotten from Dr. Harrison and his son, Ryan, this really helped. And I would, anybody that listens to this, I strongly suggest that you get online and look at Dr. Harrison's stuff. Those boards that we got, I have 2 in my briefcase right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we go on the road this spring, I will put those up. We're taking BP. If you ever came watch us take BP, you'll see those boards on the backside of the portable BP protection screen. So our guys are doing those all the time, especially early. I set them up every day. Later on, I don't do it every day, but early on, we do it every day during BP. So after you're done hitting, they rotate over to one of those vision boards and they do it before they hit again.
Very cool. And I know you guys, are huge into Driveline on the pitching side. And I got the opportunity to listen to Coach Yeski last year at the ABCA, and he did an absolutely fantastic job of really summing up everything that you guys did on the pitching side. But I want to know what from a head coaching point of view, do you guys use a lot of data? Because I know that it's something that it's becoming more and more popular, and in a way that I get a ton of information from a ton of different guests on what they use. But I want to know how do we take all of that different stuff and simplify it? And so what do you guys use, and what have you guys found useful within that, the team setting, with all the different data that you guys could have? But what do you guys use, and what do you guys like to use on a daily basis, if that makes sense?
Oh, absolutely it does. And I'm going to go back to a baseball. It's 5 ounces. I think it has 128 stitches on it. I'm not sure, but I think the diameter or the circumference, something like that, is 9 inches. And we can make baseball as complicated as we want. I think it's a complicated sport that guys that are really good coaches simplify it. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about data and information, and I'll just give you a quick example. Let's talk for a minute about launch angle.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, everybody has a launch angle.
Right.
If you look at the parabola of a bat when it's hit, I mean, Biokinetic Research Institute, Bob Kies, who runs Biokinetic Institute, I think Bob's been worked with Major League Baseball for almost 40 years now. I remember, it was probably back in like 1996, 97, Bob spoke at the National Clinic, the ABCA Clinic, and he talked about the bat going 3.5 to all the way up to 6 inches below the baseball before it comes into contact where you actually hit a baseball, which is out front. When Bob said that, and then all this launch angle stuff came up, I thought, well, there's, other than actually measuring, everybody has a launch angle.
Mm-hmm.
The launch angle thing last year was huge. I'm not hearing it near as much this year. We don't talk about launch angles. A guy's launch angle is a guy's launch angle. The other thing I'll tell you about launch angle is, for the first time in the history of Major League Baseball, there were more strikeouts than there were hits.
Mm-hmm.
So when all this launch angle stuff came up and got really big about 2 years ago, and really, really big last year, and going into this year, because guys were trying to change their degree of launch angle, making it more up to hip, more home runs, or whatever they're trying to do, strikeouts went up. And what did pitchers do? Pitchers started throwing the ball up in the zone.
Right.
Because if you're trying to create a launch angle, it's just going to get higher. And how long you stay on plane with a pitch, if your launch angle goes up, is going to be less. So J.D. Martinez, I don't know if you read the article that came out about 2 months ago, but his launch angle 2 years ago was, I think it was right around, I think it was 12.5 degrees or 13 degrees, something like that. And because he was having a hard time catching up to high pitches, he went back to really trying to stay on plane longer. His launch angle last year went down to an average of 10.5 degrees. And he still, I think he ended up with, 34, 38 home runs
mm-hmm.
with the Red Sox, and had a great year for him. So for me, an example of launch angle thing, how about just pre-pitch rhythm and movement? How about getting down on time? Starting your swing with your lower half means that you're down on time. And letting your launch angle be your launch angle based on how God made you. I mean, everybody's different. Everybody has different arm lengths, different finger lengths. Some guys' fingers are thicker than others. I mean, come on. The launch angle thing, me personally, has driven me crazy. I don't think it's not. For me, it's a non-beach. Whatever guy's launch angle is, a guy's launch angle is. So that's an example of looking at information, and there was so much stuff on it when it really became popular. And like I said, you're not seeing so much stuff on it right now. Spin rate and things like that with TrackMan data and Rapsody information. I think all that stuff's really good. I think it's a good measurement in terms of looking at guys when you're recruiting and making decisions on recruiting. But to sit there and talk to a guy about his spin rate and how that needs to change or stuff, doesn't that have to do with how God made you and your arm angle and the speed with which the ball comes off your fingers, I don't think you can change that. So anyhow, I think the information is good as long as it's used properly. I don't think you need to overload your players with that information.
Let me take a few seconds to tell you guys about On Base U. On Base University is an organization that studies how the human body moves in baseball and softball. They offer certification seminars that teach coaches, trainers, and medical professionals how to assess an athlete's physical ability to perform movement patterns that are specific to hitting and pitching. For example, they just put up a blog post on their website, onbaseu.com, that discussed why hip internal rotation is important in hitting and how they evaluate it with their On Base U screen. If you want to learn more about On Base U, I did a podcast with the On Base U founder, Dr. Greg Rose, episode 78, and he talked about how he modeled the screen after golf assessments that he created for TPI. They are hosting pitching and hitting seminars in Phoenix, Newark, and Houston over the next few months. I will be attending one soon, and I hope to see you there. Sure, absolutely. And, you know, it's something that, again, I think it's going to get more and more prevalent just because you can set a number to this or that. And I think that we as coaches need to understand it just so we can break it down for the players whenever they're given all of that information as well. But you mentioned that it helps you guys on the recruiting trail. And you guys have a ton of former players that went on to be first round picks and were lower drafted or may not even have been drafted. And so I want to know, what are you guys looking for whenever you are recruiting? And you mentioned that you want them to be great men off the field first, but whenever you're going and watching them play, what are some of the things that you guys are looking for?
Well, I think one of the key things is when you recruit guys, if they're really good students, it's not necessarily because they're smarter than other people, it's because they're hard workers.
Yeah, that's good.
And so I think that's the first thing. The thing is, if young men are really good students in high school, I'm talking 3.5 and higher GPA guys. If they're really good students in high school, it's probably because they're doing things right on and off the field. When young men are doing things that are morally wrong on and off the field and doing stuff that's inhibiting their performance in the classroom and on the field, you know, their priorities are out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And you recruit very many of those guys, and they'll have a negative impact on your program. So, you know, and then there's things that factor in where guys aren't getting good grades. Maybe a key member of the family died. Mom and dad got divorced. You know, things like that also work into young men not getting as good grades as they should in high school, and they end up doing really well in college. So you have to look at all those factors as well.
No, I love that, and that's definitely the case, and I'm sure that you guys take that on a case by case basis and go from there. And so you're getting guys now that are ranked nationally, and they're coming in as some of the best, the top of their class. And for me, you know, we all want to get better individually. We all want to get better individually. We all want to get better as a team. And so whenever you're getting those guys, especially whenever you get them in several different or the same position in several different classes, and they're having to compete every single day, how do you kind of sell the individual development within the team setting, maybe even if they're not playing every single day? And what does that individual player development look like within the Oregon State setting?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing is, like I told you at the very beginning, we're a teaching program.
Mm-hmm.
And I think guys improve and get better because we do teach. I also think it's because the type of guys that we get in here, they're learners. And I think if you're a learner, your learning curve's going to be a lot higher. If you're willing to take, and it also has to do with guys' personalities, because every guy's different. Some guys are bigger risk takers than others. You know, when I was a young coach, I used to think, well, that guy's not very coachable. Well, because I've grown as a coach over the years, this is my 41st year of coaching. I don't think that's true at all. I think it has to do with, if a guy hit 450, 500 in high school, and he's not a big risk taker, his learning curve is not going to be as sharp as another guy who hit 400, 500 in high school and is a big risk taker. His learning curve is going to be higher because he's willing to take risks to change things to get better. So part of that is you have to look at a guy's personality as well.
Perfect, perfect. And, you know, that's something that I have continued to grow myself. I think that and this sounds so weird, but I think that my least amount of learning came within the actual school setting. And it's crazy that once you get them locked in and get them to believe in something that helps them to grow themselves, I think that you've won them over, and I think you've got them from there.
Yeah, well, the first thing they have to do is they have to trust you. If they don't trust what you're teaching is correct, there's not going to be buy-in. And so you have to, you know, you have to be knowledgeable on what you're talking about. Guys are really smart. You can't fool them. You have to be honest. If there is something that you don't know and ask you a question, tell them you don't know and you'll look it up, or you'll get some help from somebody else. So kids aren't stupid. They see through coaches really quick. Mm-hmm. So you can't fool people. So the trust thing, I think, is really important. And once they trust you, and sometimes it takes a guy failing a lot before they'll come to you and say, "Hey, coach, I need your help." Some guys want help. The flip side, which is the other extreme, is a guy will go 0-for-4 and he'll want to go spend 2 hours in the batting cage. Mm-hmm. And we obviously can't spend 2 hours with them, but they'll go in there by themselves for 2 hours to hit because they went 0-for-4. And that's silly. I mean, everybody's going to have 0-for-4 days.
Right.
So it's just, I think that the key thing is our profession is no different than being a good doctor, a good lawyer, or a physicist, or a nuclear engineer, whatever it is you're doing. If you want to be great at it, you got to study, and you got to look at information. And, you know, as you mature as a coach, you filter information, you take information you think's good, that you believe in, you trust, and then you throw the other information out. So you do what you think is going to help you in your program and get better. But when you talk about our players coming in, you said a few minutes ago about talent. We get a lot of talented players. Mm-hmm. And I really believe the key when you get a lot of talented players coming in is to buy into the team concept. And if they buy into the team concept and you do things in your program that will help them to really literally care for one another like a brotherhood and fall in love with each other. As a brotherhood, it's a key to winning. It's a key ingredient to winning. And that's where the character piece really comes in and matters. And that's where making other people more important than yourself matter. You know, I was talking yesterday, we finished a hitting camp, and I told them, I said, awards are great, but they're inanimate objects. They're not going to make you happy. Just like a big house isn't going to make you happy. A brand new car is not going to make you happy. A brand new car, after you've had it for a couple months, takes you from point A to point B. And as long as you take care of it, it's going to continue to take you from point A to point B, but it's not going to matter in terms of how you feel about it. The key to being happy is making other people more important than yourself. And the second key to being happy it's about relationships. It's everybody wants to be accepted unconditionally, and they want to be unconditionally loved. And so coaches have to learn that guys have different personalities. Mm-hmm. And if they know that you really care, that you really care about them, you have your best interest or their best interests in mind, and that it's not about you as a coach, not about you winning as a coach. It's about helping them become men. And helping them become good teammates and helping them to really just enjoy and care for one another, then the winning part takes care of itself.
So is that something that, let's say that Coach Bailey went back and told his 21, 22-year-old first-year coach self, would that be what you would basically tell yourself?
Oh my goodness. When I first started coaching, all I cared about, I'm not going to say I didn't care about the kids, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to lie. I think I cared more about winning than I did the kids. And I think that all changed when my wife and I started having children. I think that really helped because there's times when I thought, now if that was my son or that was my daughter, would I talk to them that way? Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't. So I think that part helped. When I was 26 years old, my first year as a head coach, I contacted I got spinal meningitis as we were getting ready to go into the state playoffs when I was at Willamette High School. And I was in critical condition for 3 days. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. There were 17 cases in Lane County, which is the county in Eugene, Oregon. 12 of those cases died. I was one of five that lived, and I was the only one of five that didn't lose fingers or toes.
Wow.
And I had to have 40 pints of blood while I was in the hospital. Anyhow, all that for me made me realize just, it made me reevaluate what is really important in life. And it had a huge impact on my life. And I think that probably helped change things too.
Wow, man, that's I did not know that story, and that's crazy. And wow, that would definitely change my perspective as well. And you know, on the same tone, I think, you know, most of us as young young coaches, I think we all kind of feel like that, because that's kind of, at least this is how I felt whenever I was 21 and I was teaching a high school age kids. I was teaching a senior government class, and I was like 3 years older. I felt like the relationships was the last thing that I wanted to do, because I didn't want to seem like their friend. And, you know, the more that I get to speak with awesome coaches as yourself and guys who have been in it for a long, long time, that seems to be the foundation of literally everything, because we can learn as much as we want, and we can win as many games as we want. But if we're not building relationships with our players, I think we're doing it in a way that is not going to be satisfying in the long run.
Oh, I 100% agree. And, you know, when I first started teaching coaching, I was 22, so I was about your age as well. And one of the things I learned in a hurry, especially in the classroom, is you're not there to be their buddies. You're there to mentor them.
Right.
And that's like I've told people, I have zero interest in having an 18-year-old as a friend. I'm there to be a father figure for them. I'm there to love them unconditionally. I'm there to mentor them and help them become men. And so I think that's the key relationship-wise for a coach versus a player. To be when parents hand the baton to coaches in college, to help out. And let's just talk about high school for a minute, because
sure.
It sounds like you're, are you currently a high school coach?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Well, think about this. I bet you in high school, the amount of time you spent with your players in a daily basis is more time than they spent at home with their parents.
Yep.
So the critical role that you fill in those guys' lives, they're going to remember things 25 years from now that you said, that are going to have an impact on their lives, both positive and negative. And I'll just give you a really clear example of that. About, I'm going to say 1992, I had a young man in a class, a business law class, and he came up right before the final and he said, "Can you give me my total points so far and the points that, how many points that I could have gotten, how many points I actually have, what my percentage is?" And I showed him, I put it on a piece of paper, and I said, "I know what you're asking. You're a really smart guy. You're a straight A student. And you want to know the minimum amount you have to get on your final and still get an A in this class." And he goes, "Well, I have a lot of finals next week." And I said, "If you don't do your best on this final, you're going to be disappointed."
Mm-hmm.
You might not be disappointed now, but if you take shortcuts now, you're going to do it later on. So he took the final and he got like a 78. And just barely had enough to get an A versus an A minus. And I wrote on his paper, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was like weak performance. I expect more out of you. You take shortcuts now, you're going to take shortcuts later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
He calls me when he's 32 years old and said he was so mad at me when he got his paper back. But he said, "Your comments have had a direct impact on my life. And everything I've done, whether it's being a husband, a father, a worker, I always think about that and I always give my best in everything I do."
Wow.
And I mean, that was one of those things where I didn't think that was that big of a deal, other than I was mad at him. Because he was also an athlete. He played football in college. So anyhow, I mean, you just don't know the things that you're going to say that are going to have a huge impact on young people's lives. So he you have a major opportunity to have both a positive influence and potentially a negative influence on a person's future. And the last thing I'll tell you that's really important with talking to your student athletes, never attack the person. You can attack the behavior and try to change behavior. The person's okay. The behavior might not be acceptable. So you got to be really careful what you say to your student athletes in terms of it, of how you say it, and even the tone that it's said at, I think is really important. But it has to, you have to attack behavior. Don't attack the person.
I love that. And that is extremely, extremely good. And so, you know, Coach, whenever I'm trying to be more reflective and just looking back and continuing to look forward and continuing to try and better myself. And that's really, you know, why I started the podcast. But whenever you look back, let's say in 30 years, whenever you're done coaching and you decide to finally hang them up and you look back and on the run that you guys have had and the run that you're currently on, and you've won 3 titles in the past 12 years, and you look back and you're, let's say you're just having a conversation and someone asks you this and just, you know, and answer this however you may, but what would you say that you guys do differently? Because for the most part, everyone has access to the same recruits. Everyone has access to the same data and the same 90-foot bases and the same 5-ounce baseball that you mentioned earlier. But if you looked back and you just said, man, I really truly think that this is what we do differently than everybody else, what would that be?
Well, I think first and foremost, what we've been talking about, we're in the man building and the relationship business. And I really firmly and believe from the bottom of my heart that if young men know that that you really care for them and that they trust you, you're going to have a huge impact and influence on their lives. That'd be the first thing. The second thing is, I think it's really important that a coach is a student of the game. And there's a reason why God gave us 2 ears and one mouth, and that's to be a learner and a listener. And it's funny because yesterday I told the young people in our baseball camp, isn't it interesting your ears have no protection, but your tongue has protection of both your teeth and your lips? And the other reason why I think that we were created that way is because we need to listen more and talk less. And so I just think it's important that you really try to put yourself in your players' shoes and see where they're at in life and help them out. So I just think all those things are really critical. And going to clinics, I remember when I was 28 years old, I wanted to be a college coach. And I wrote down goals. And one of the things I wrote down at the time was, I'm going to read at least one book a month, whether it's a baseball book and I read a lot of leadership books, John Maxwell books. I think if you're going to be a coach and you're going to be a leader, you better understand what leadership is. And so I made a commitment that I was going to read at least one book a month. I made a commitment that I was going to go to at least 2 clinics a year. And I've been to the American Baseball Coach Association clinic since 1987, probably every year, but maybe 5 or 6 during that time. So I just think it's really important that you have an open mind and listen to other people and learn from them. And, you know, even if you went to, like, when I go to the ABCA clinic next week, when I go to all those sessions, first of all, I want to get there early enough where I'm going to be close enough front where I can actually listen and learn and take notes and do whatever I need to do. But secondly, be open-minded enough that, hey, you know, this is the way I've done this the last 15 years, but maybe this is a better way. And just be open-minded in terms of what works and what doesn't work and maybe making adjustments. One of the things that we've done more the last couple of years in practice, and I think it's really helped our guys out, is we've created more randomness in practice.
Okay.
And I'll just give you an example. We combine our outfield rules and relays with our fly ball communication. And we also this year added runners to the fly ball communication part. So we have runners in different situations. So our outfielders are actually having to, you know, do in-game decision-making along with our infielders in terms of proper alignment based on where the ball's hitting, where the runner is located. So between a ground ball and a fly ball, those type of things, where it's just everything goes to the outfield. None of it stays in the infield. It's either a fly ball or a base hit. where they have to make in-game decisions. And there's also randomness in it in terms of a ground ball base hit, line drive base hit, a fly ball that's really deep. Because sometimes you have to double cut fly balls because if it gets over the cut and there's a runner at second, you could score from second. So just all that stuff gets added in to combine those. And we've also combined our first and third in our bunt defenses. Nate came up with the island drill. So, you know, we've tried to do more things because when you have randomness in practice, it puts more pressure on your team. And I think the more in-game decision-making, randomness and pressure that occurs, the easier the game's going to be when you actually play the game.
Sure. And we want them to be better decision makers than how, and this is something that I've been all in on the past couple of months, just because I keep hearing it. And obviously with yourself and other people talking about it that are better than me, I'm like, man, I need to listen. But if we're asking them to make better decisions, then how are we practicing that? And you've mentioned the island drill a couple of times. Do you mind digging into that a little bit?
Yeah, we call it the island drill because Nate has one pitcher at a time. Because everything else we do, we have three pitchers out there. Because when you run practice, you're trying to utilize time as best as you can. And so we have multiple drills going. Like when we do PFPs, we have three pitchers out there at a time while we're doing PFPs. Mm-hmm. So that a lot of things are going on. But the island drill, pitcher goes out to the mound. It's just a pitcher in the infield. And you create different scenarios. And you just, you know, it's just random stuff. Runner at first base, no outs. You know, Nate's either going to, he's going to bunt, he's going to drag, he's going to push, he's going to hit a ground ball where a pitcher has to turn a double play. Whatever it is, the play is going to involve the pitcher. And so that's the island drill. Might have a guy at first base and he's stealing, a catcher has to throw him out, and a pitcher has to be quick to the play. It just involves everything that happens within an infield during the game that involves the pitcher. So that's what the island drill is.
Well, perfect. So before you go, I've got one more question for you, and this is probably, you know, my favorite question that I ask any coach, because we're in it for the kids. We're in it to build better men, to build better baseball players, but say you show up to practice tomorrow or whenever you guys are starting practice and you say, hey guys, we're going to do this drill today or we're going to do this thing in practice, and they just erupt because they absolutely love it. What would that thing or things be?
Gosh, that's a great question. We do a thing called a hustle scrimmage or two pitch. They really enjoy doing that. Whenever I tell them, today's a grip and rip day. It's a day where they just get to hit without having to do it, which we rarely do in practice. They love doing that. You know, maybe you've been working really hard and you come up with a competition day, which we've done a few times, where we just do competitive type things the entire practice. Whether it's, I created a long time ago what I call a 30-foot drag game. And it's, the bases are 30 feet, and you play a game with that, and you score points based on whether a guy's safe or out at first base. That, if they're safe, it's a point. If they're out, they don't get any points, and they get three outs, and you rotate, and you have teams, and you run a tournament with it. You can even play, and this sounds silly, but there's been a few times since I've been a college coach where we've actually played over-the-line tournaments, which is fun. But I mean, you're there to teach and coach. So those days, they don't happen super a lot. The part about gripping and ripping, that happens quite a bit. Hustle scrimmage or two pitch at the end of practice, we do that quite a bit too on days that we don't scrimmage. So, you know, you got to pick your slots. You can't do that kind of stuff all the time. I mean, the funnest part about baseball is winning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's just be honest about it. That's when they tear that scoreboard down, they can't quite keep and score. Then you can just go out and do whatever you want. But until they do, you're there to teach. You're there to mentor. You're there to build relationships, and you're there to help guys. And so, I think that part's really important. The last thing I want to say before we quit,
sure.
When you're talking about a relationship business, 10 years from now, if I wasn't coaching, you think any of our players would care how much we won, or would you think they care more about the impact we had on their lives, the relationships we developed with them. I mean, one of the coolest things I ever have done as a coach is Jake Rodriguez, who's now on our staff. Jake was a catcher for us. He finished and he was drafted in 13 when we went to the World Series in 2013. And then when he got released, he came back and started working with us. I married him and his wife.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that kind of stuff to me is way more important than the baseball side of it. It's something I'll never forget. And to have an opportunity to do that for one of my former players was just amazing. I had to get my pastor's license or whatever you want to call it to be able to marry him, because I needed a license so that the marriage was legal. But since then I've married four couples. So,
wow, that's awesome.
Including my son and my daughter-in-law. So it's just, you know, those kind of things have more meaning than the actual wins and the journey. You know, people asked me about last year. You know, if you're coaching just to win a national championship and you finally win a national championship, that's going to be an empty feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody wants to win a national championship. Very few people get an opportunity. I mean, I've been blessed. I've been in a state championship in high school, won a national championship at George Fox, had an opportunity to be a part of a national championship here at Oregon State. I mean, I've been fortunate. There's a lot of great coaches out there that have never got the experience what I've got the experience. But one of the things I can tell you is that the national championship part is not as important as building that. And the national championship part is just a byproduct of what you've done during the course of the year. And we were blessed with a lot of talent last year. I mean, Nick Madrigal, Caden Grenier, Trevor Larnick, all first-round draft pick guys. Stephen Kwan developed into a great baseball player. And the common thread between all those guys, for me, is they were what I would call legacy guys. They were guys that were really hard workers, but they also had an impact on your team. And they helped our team. Those guys leave and put our team in a better place than when they found it, if that makes sense. So, you know, they had a huge impact on our team and our program, and not just as baseball players, but as human beings.
No, that's fantastic. Well, Coach, I can't think of a better way to end the show than that. But if there are any listeners who, you know, would love to get in touch with you and just touch base or just say hello, what would be the best way to do that?
By email, probably, to start with.
Okay.
And I'm at a point where I love helping young coaches out.
Okay.
So my email address is pat.bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y, at Oregon State, and you have to spell it Oregon State, .edu for education.
Awesome. Well, I am going to open up the mic for you, and is there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners before you go?
No, I just really appreciate the opportunity to talk and being a guy that's been in the profession for a while. I just hope that coaches really buy into what I talked about in terms of this being a relationship build business, and we're here to build that because it's going to make our country better if coaches buy into that, because we have a huge impact on young people's lives.
Thank you for listening to Ahead of the Curve. Before you go, I'd love to be able to get in touch with you, and we have several different ways of doing so. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at AOTC_podcast. You can join the AOTC Coaches Facebook group, and if you want to be a part of the mini clinic emails, both of those links are listed below. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating or review to help others find and stay ahead of the curve.